And welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus on this beautiful Friday, 1:07 in the afternoon. We're at the tail end of January, February right around the corner, and it's looking and feeling like January out there. We've had a few snow showers move through the area. It really hasn't amounted to a whole lot, but well, things could change a little bit tomorrow as the winds ramp up and we could be dealing with more of a blowing snow issue. I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, along with our Ag Director, Bridget Riedel. Bridget, how's your afternoon going here so far?
Well, like we tell people when they call us from the southern states, we're not standing outside in this, but it's not a bad day out there. So, in fact, I can tell the sun's trying to shine just a little bit. And as you mentioned, tomorrow likely going to change. There are some folks, northern end of the valley did receive some freezing rain earlier today. And if we look at the road report, which I'm going to do right now, snow covered from Fargo headed north. There were some flurries right here at my location not that long, long ago. And of course, West Fargo, the Castleton, icy as usual. Also, you're going to do a little skating around the Jamestown and Devil's Lake area. So be careful out there. Because of that freezing snow, you're going to want to just take it a little freezing rain and drizzle. You're going to want to take that a little bit easy and be cautious in those areas.
Yeah, little bit of wintry weather, but nothing we haven't seen. No big storms, so that's good news there. But as I said, tomorrow could be a little different story. Now we're not looking at a lot of snow. We'll see a few more snow showers overnight, but I think we'll see a quick little burst of snow showers tomorrow morning, along with some pretty strong northwest winds, and that could deposit about another couple tenths of an inch of snow. But the winds will ramp up out of the northwest at about 20 to 30 and gusty, and that's going to provide blowing snow, especially east of the valley. The reason I say that is there's going to be a little more fresh snow east of the valley into Lakes Country. So keep that in mind if you're doing any traveling tomorrow. But even around the FM area and up and down the valley, we'll deal with blowing snow tomorrow. So that could lead to a little bit of a problem and with temperatures in the teens after topping out in the upper 20s today. Sunday will still be breezy, but temperatures not bad in the upper 20s. And then Monday, next week is going to be a big roller coaster week. We're going to start the week in the mid 30s on Monday. And then by Wednesday, we drop back down into the teens. And then by the end of next week, we're probably back up into the mid 30s again. And that rounds out the month of January. And as we look into February, according to the LRC, something's cooking that first week of the month. Now, there's definitely going to be at least one storm that affects our area during that first week, possibly two. We'll wait and see how that pans out, but definitely going to start the month of February a little stormier the way it looks like. Now, there's a couple of the models trying to keep this system down to our south, but I do think we're going to be affected by this that first week of February. So we'll end the month on a quiet note, but we'll start the month of February more than likely on the stormy side, which isn't a bad thing. Again, we need the moisture and we need the snow. So hopefully we can oblige and get that in here before Bridget goes out to agronomy on ice.
Well, it depends what you mean by storm. If we're just going to get some snow, fine. If we have to deal with ice, I'm not so happy about the road conditions when that happens, but we'll keep an eye on it.
Right.
As always, this first segment weather update is sponsored by Ryan Bonesack. Ryan is with Equitable AgriFinance. He is here to help farmers as well as ranchers do some restructuring and working on their balance sheets. He can give you working capital and help you make good business decisions. So give him a chance. Give him a call at 701-261-6529. Again, that would be Ryan Bonesack. He is with Equitable AgriFinance. And I think that right now, as far as most weather conditions, we're feeling pretty good about it. Like you said, we'll have a little bit of an up and down next week. But realistically, after we crawled out of the deep freeze that we had over the weekend, I mean, my house cracks many times in that cold weather. I thought it was going to just pop apart. So glad to hear things are getting a little bit better.
Yeah, it is.
Which is nice.
Yeah. And according to the LRC, February and March are supposed to be temperatures at or above normal. So that's tolerable. It doesn't mean we won't have cold snaps, but on the whole, February and March are supposed to be at or above normal. And same with precip. I think precip's going to be at or above normal as well for the month of February and March. So that's good news. We need it.
And
And
they're improving.
Yeah, and the new LRC We're going to get a new run on this weekend, and we'll take a peek into what March and April look like as well. I got a sneak peek at one of the model runs from last week, and it looks like as we go into spring, there's going to be pockets of below normal precip all the way through spring, and then there's also going to be pockets of at or above normal. I think most of us are going to be okay. I don't think we're going to have to worry about any flooding. I don't think we're going to have to worry about any excessive moisture as we head into spring. Now, we can always get that one storm, you know, that dumps some heavier rainfall. But overall, I think the heavier precip this spring right now, and again, we'll see what the new LRC run this weekend holds, looks to be to our south and east. In areas which have been bone dry this winter. That's great news for South Dakota, for Nebraska, for Iowa, for southern Minnesota. Those areas that have been extremely dry, those look to be the areas that will see some heavier amounts of precip as we head into spring. Good news for our ag community to our south. I do think we'll be on the northern end of that. So I think we're going to be okay here in the valley and in the lakes country.
What's going to matter is there moisture content? You know, we can get snow, but it doesn't add up to anything.
Right.
So, you know, some moisture content would be rather helpful in all of this.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about it.
Now, where do snowflakes, the adage that snows to snowflakes look alike, come from? Actually, a dairy farmer. His name is Wilson Bentley. He was born in 1865 in Vermont. And he worked on his family farm his entire life, but he wanted to be a much more educated man. His mother was a school teacher. And ironically, she had a very early microscope. So what he used to do was take his mom's microscope and he would find ways to get snowflakes. And he would be out by an unheated building and take the snowflakes in and look at them under the microscope. And he realized how very cool they were and how different. So looking ahead, he then talked his family into buying a camera. And at the time, it cost them about $100. When land was being sold for $3 an acre, this was a significant investment that mom and dad decided to make. But they were a frugal family, and as Bentley grew up, he lived with his brother, sister-in-law, and their 8 children in one house. So there was a lot of expenses being saved so that Bentley could have a camera. But what he did then do was he had a black tray. He would catch snowflakes, put them under the camera, and take pictures of them. He then put together a collection of 5,000 different snowflake photos that are now held by the Smithsonian. Think about the accuracy and clarity of what he had to be doing at the time. If he needed to move them, he would use a single straw, like a broom straw, to move those snowflakes so he could quickly take photos. And the reason that the Smithsonian holds them is that work was so well regarded, jewelers, engravers, textile makers, including Tiffany & Company, still refer to those photographs for design photos that they want to use when they're building jewelry and other things as well. So that's where all the snowflake photos came from. He was a dairy farmer in Vermont.
And what year was that, Bridget?
He was born in 1865. He turned all of the things over to the Smithsonian in 1904,
wow,
is when he had already had all these photos done. So this was not a great camera system versus what we're using right now, but his accuracy and clarity was just tremendous. And he realized, you know, what air temperature changes did to a snowflake as it would reach the ground. And some of his hypotheses were proven true by scientists much later who said, yes, this guy was way ahead of his time in the work that he did. It was a pretty neat deal.
That's awesome.
He was a busy guy.
And $100 back then, man, like you said, I mean, what was it selling per acre? I mean, that's $100. Wow.
Yeah, they were spending $3 an acre on land.
Jeez.
And they spent $100 to make sure that they could go buy this camera for him. But he was regarded as an excellent dairy farmer, worked very diligently with their livestock on their operation, but yet continued his passion of science. And one of those things was snowflakes.
That's pretty cool.
Speaking of those with passion, that's going to be our guest today. And I want to introduce his work before we get to Bruce. And I should have called Bruce to make sure I say his last name right. I think it's Jovig, J-J-O-V-I-G. And we're going to talk to Bruce today. These are just two of his books on innovative entrepreneurs here in North Dakota. for those of you who follow me on Facebook and Instagram, you know that today is Farm Fact Friday, and I do a video every week of farm facts coming straight out of North Dakota. And Bruce's books have been, as you can see, wonderful references for me, as I was able to pull information here on entrepreneurs who developed so many things that we are familiar with here around the United States, but they originated in North Dakota. Certainly discussions about a number of the bonanza farms that have been here, but also, you know, American Crystal Sugar, Cream of Wheat, even things in the livestock arena such as Schaff Angus Ranch and Triple V out by the Triple V Ranch out by Watford City, which is how we originated branding and North Dakota Stockman's Association in the state of North Dakota. We had the Wheat Kings. We have folks with Melrow, Bobcat, Wahpeton Canvas, and so many more. And Bruce is a wonderful storyteller. There's no way we have enough time in our show today to be able to talk about all of the things that he knows, but we're just going to get started. And again, that's going to be with author and historian here in North Dakota, Bruce Joving. And we're going to talk to him about some of those ag-related stories that he knows so well. We're going to do that after we have a moment to catch up with our markets from the American Ag Network, and we'll be right back. Welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus. And today I feel like is a history lesson in the making. So for those of you who have picked up any of these books in the region, Innovative Entrepreneurs from North Dakota, and there is also a version of North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. This is two of three books, and they are written by Bruce Govig. And maybe it's Jovig. Bruce, I have to ask, how am I saying your last name wrong? What should I be saying instead?
Pronounce it with the Norwegian, then it's more with the wine sound, Jovig.
Yes.
Jovig's just is American.
I am not Norwegian enough sometimes to be able to answer all of those things. So,
if I remember right, you're from Wichig, so you're from that German triangle.
Yes, and so I have a very different accent that happens from down south. So, I have to ask, how did this start? How did you start looking at all of these wonderful people in the history of the region to be able to compile the books that you have?
Well, as an entrepreneur coach at the University of North Dakota, I really got an interest in entrepreneurs and the history of entrepreneurs. So I started collecting them. And then we started a program, the North Dakota Entrepreneur Hall of Fame, which we were recognizing North Dakota entrepreneurs. And we did that specifically because a lot of North Dakotans believe that good things happen elsewhere, but didn't happen here. So by honoring people who were very successful, tried to make them believers that we still can do outstanding things here.
You have done a masterful job of that.
Well, we have to make ourselves believers, right? If you believe you can do it, you can do it. If you believe you can't, well, you can't.
If you were to look at the list of those who you have in your books, I recognize names of companies that are still in operation today. As a percentage, would you say that 60 or 70% of the folks that you have profiled are still viable companies today, even if they've perhaps changed names or changed hands?
I don't have an exact number, but I would say that's a good guess.
Okay.
I wasn't prepared for that question, but I think you make a good point because they've really been around forever. I mean, you think of, for example, American Crystal Sugar. They really started in the 1920s. 100 years later, it's still here. Cream of Wheat is still known as a product, not as a company, but as a product, right? C.H. Robinson Company is still the largest trucking company, fresh produce company in the world. That started in the 1890s. Nash Finch is now a Nash Spartan, but it's merged, but it's still around, and that's almost 150 years old. So there's a lot of them are still around.
And Bruce, out of these companies, that these bigger companies that are around and that have sustained themselves, what are they doing right opposed to some of these companies that just can't make it? Is there a magic formula? Is there, or is it more so what these other companies that are failing, what they're doing wrong?
Well, it's a multitude of factors. Certainly, it takes an innovative, good product, that meets a real need or solves a problem or creates an opportunity. It really needs to be viable in terms of the marketplace. You've got customers and plenty of customers. You got to have your competitive advantage. You got to be able to survive recessions, depressions, you know, hard times, and a lot of them do that. And you got to have good management, you know, and so leadership and management is extremely important. So there's a lot of factors in there. But it is, you know, they've always, you know, the ones that survive can really manage. They've got good products, a good market, a good economy, good margins. They got good leadership, and they're able to sustain that.
And they're risk takers. You know, these folks said, I'm going to stick my neck out in an opportunity that somebody else may completely overlook. And it paid off in so many ways for these folks.
That is also true. Sometimes solving the problem, and then when you solve it, it's intuitive and obvious to others, but you're the first one to do it.
This is probably going to be a hard question, Bruce. And we didn't prep any questions beforehand because, you know, so many things just arise as we talk. Plus, we can have any of our listeners reach out to us, and they can do that via our phone number of 701-293-9000. So, Bruce, if there was a, is it possible to choose a favorite story or a someone that you really love using as an example of the entrepreneurs that you've researched, or some favorite tidbits about them? What are some of those things that come to mind that you love to share?
Well, when I was preparing for the show today, Bridget, I was thinking about that. And let me tell you what I landed on that we talked about briefly when we had this conversation in December at the Christmas party in Hillsboro. The Red River Valley has been the leader in ag technology since the Bonanza Farmers. This is the 150th year. Oliver Dalrymple was the first and became the largest of the 92 Bonanza Farms in North Dakota. And he started that in 1875, precisely 150 years ago this year. I am still trying to figure out how North Dakota farmers still keep adapting to new technologies, new ways of doing things, to still be a leader in the ag industry in the Red River Valley after 150 years. You know, Detroit's having a terrible time being the leader in the car industry, automobile industry. Wichita is no longer the leader in the general aircraft industry. Silicon Valley is falling apart as a leader in the high-tech industry. I mean, you look around the world, and there's not a lot of places that can sustain leadership for 150 years, and yet they've done that. And so I pay, you know, I think those 92 Bonanza Farmers started something that still continues today, which is sort of amazing me. And I know there's a factor to it. We talked about it. Our distance from market means you got to constantly innovate to be competitive over people who are closer to major markets. And so that innovation factor, there's a real reason to continue innovating. But those Bonanza Farmers, in which basically the homesteaders watched and looked at, and they adapted some of those same management tech teams and some of those, you know, new technologies that come out. And if you remember, McCormick, John Deere, International Harvester, all tested their new farm equipment in the Red River Valley in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And they use it as a marketing tool to say, this has been tested in the Red River Valley, because these were the early adapters of new technology work. I'm not the right ag historian to do this, but there is a real story here to be told of 150 years of innovation in ag.
Oh, it's tremendous. And you're exactly right. When we look at the adaptation rate of precision agriculture and technology across the U.S., North Dakota leads that charge by double digits as how quickly our farmers become adaptive. And as you said, that pioneering spirit remains in so many. Bruce, I have favorite stories I want to ask you about from your books. I'm very much looking forward to doing that.
Have you gotten a copy of Jack Dalrymple's book yet? Oliver Dalrymple and his Bonanza Farm.
Oh, I don't have that one yet.
Just came out in the fall, last fall. I got a copy of it when I was in Bismarck. What a great book. And it's really, so I reread that very quickly again for today's show, because I think the Oliver Dalrymple story is so interesting. you know, and how it became first of the 92 Bonanza Farms.
We are going to have so many questions for you. We do need to stop and check with our bottom of the hour news right now, but Bruce, stay tuned. Let's start talking about those Bonanza Farms, because some of those innovations linger on today, including some of the towns that were built. And we'll talk about that when we return. Welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus and today's history lesson of ag, entrepreneurs, and innovation in the Red River Valley and the region, really, covering North Dakota and Minnesota. Our guest today is the, do I call you the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at UND? Is that correct, Bruce?
I'm the founder emeritus, so I am retired. I retired in 2017. After 35
years. I've seen how many books you write. You're the worst retired person I've ever met. So no, that's not true.
Let's just say I have no employees.
So you told us that you quickly reread a book in regards to Oliver Dalrymple, one of the first Bonanza farmers in this region. And the Dalrymple name is synonymous with the city of Castleton, North Dakota. But was Oliver here initially as a farmer, or did he come as a farm manager and that devolved into what became his operation?
Well, firstly, he grew up on a Pennsylvania farm, so he had a farm background. He went to Yale, became an attorney, and he moved to Minneapolis in 1856. And he was working as an attorney, mostly handling homestead disputes, and he plowed his profits into owning a farm in not far out of Minneapolis. He ended up having 2,600 acres and 150 men working for him. And in 1873, he speculated on the market, and that's when the panic of 1873 came, and he lost everything. He lost $100,000, is well over $2 million. He's broke. At the same time, you know, then that panic, Northern Pacific had come into North Dakota a year or two before, and it was going west of Fargo. And they went bankrupt with the same panic. And the bonds that were issued could be converted to land. So that they saw the need to figure out how they were. So they, with their investors, they allowed, which that's what became Bonanza Farms. Then they wanted to get wheat growers out here to get wheat to Minneapolis so they would have a source of income. So you are absolutely right. They hired Oliver Dalrymple as a farm manager for 18 sections of land. And in my mind, what is that, a little over 10,000 acres or no, 1,300 acres, something like that. I'm not sure.
That's okay. I'm doing the math over here for you. It's like 11.5.
11.5. All right. So anyway, he was the farm manager, but he arranged for him. He had managed it, but after X number of years, he could own some of that land. And meanwhile, with his profits, he could buy some of that land. So at the end of the day, Dalrymple ended up owning over 30,000 acres. And had over 65,000 acres under cultivation, including that original, you know, land from Northern Pacific that he rented for him, and then it was crop sharing. But you know, he broke up all of his farms into units of 2,000 to 3,000 acres, roughly an average of 2,500 acres each. And he ended up with over 1,000 men working on these farms, 800 mules and horses, had 200 reapers, 30 steam threshers. I mean, what an operation, right? Just think about keeping track of 1,000 men and 800 horses. I mean, that just is mind-boggling to think about, right? But, you know, so it's a farm management. He really perfected it and having these smaller units. And in 1876, he went to the Philly Centennial Exhibition and he met Alexander Graham Bell and was fascinated by his invention of the phone. So he took the phone, and I think it was the next year, so that would have been 77. He started connecting his farms by phone so he could communicate between the farms. So the very first use of phone technology in North Dakota is the Dalrymple Farms. So he could use it as a farming management tool, which is really sort of, I mean, it's sort of amazing, right? And then I don't remember how he got McCormick and John Deere to come out and test their new equipment, but they sent out, you know, literally train loads of equipment for him to try in his farm. And then other Bonanza farmers were doing the same for John Deere and IH. So, I mean, he was always experimenting with new equipment. And I know the Dalrymple farm also had the first use of a car in North Dakota before 1900. It was either 98 or 99. They had some of the first edition of a car on the farm. I mean, what an innovator, always adapting new technologies. It was absolutely terrific. But, you know, I'm just mind-boggling to figure out how can you, you know, manage that many people and that many farms and, you know, and that many horses and mules. It's just, you know, before there was mechanization, it was amazing.
And, you know, in Northern they had to feed them all.
Absolutely needed him as well, right? Because they used the Darnopal farms and to get homesteaders out here after the Bonanza farmers had already, you know, Northern Pacific had, they converted their bonds into farmland in North Dakota. Then there was the homesteaders come out. And I forgot the numbers, but it seems to me there was over 100,000 homesteaders in North Dakota by 1900. Don't quote me that number. That number may not be right. But that's what comes to my mind.
And so, I mean, it was pretty close on that number. I think it was because they were doing advertisements based on what Dalrymple and others were saying out here to entice more people to come out. And it was the railroad that was really the big announcer of what was happening. And
they were the promotion, right? Because they needed these homesteaders, you know, to ship things out and ship things back, right? Ship out equipment and ship back, you know, wheat and barley, whatever else they were raising. I remember one of the great stories I heard from Hiram Drackey, by the way, is hard red spring wheat actually come from Scottish settlers through Canada. And during this panic of 1873, there was also new technology in Minneapolis for the millings where they developed really much better steel rollers. They used to use ceramic rollers, even wooden rollers to make flour. But, you know, that really did not work well with hard red spring wheat because the wheat was truly hard. So it was not until they had these steel rollers could they really make, and let's go back one step, hard red spring wheat was essential to make the highest quality wheat. But then I forgot what the particulars were where Hiram told me how the Scottish immigrants brought hard red spring wheat down with them from Canada to the Red River Valley. And that was the wheat that was essential for the high quality flour in Minneapolis, which, you know, so it was a combination of all technologies, right? Railroads being out here. So the transportation, we had all these bonanza farms. We had the homesteaders. We had the, you know, the millings come up with new milling techniques and the flour industry was, you know, fed the flour from Minneapolis, fed the world. And it was hard red spring wheat from North Dakota that fed the mills in Minneapolis. So it was really a very interesting complex of really different technologies and infrastructure that made this all possible.
You've given this great timeline of how Dalrymple was farming, was sending wheat to the mills in Minneapolis, but it was later after that, and I know you're going to know the dates way better than I do, that North Dakota farmers thought, hold on, I think we're getting hosed on pricing by the Minneapolis mills, which led to the creation of the North Dakota State Mill and Elevator, because you're right, we were bringing in hard red spring wheat, which was the highest quality for milling for flour, but we are the only state that created our own state mill and elevator, and that was to avoid financial risks to the mills in Minneapolis, right?
That's right. And that was there actually was a movement for several years here just, you know, to stop what they considered the abuse from the railroads and the millers and the bankers in Minneapolis and why they did the mill and elevator and the nonpartisan league. And 1919 was the year that they really sort of pushed, you know, to get that started. And the mill opened in 1920. So that mill is now just, you know, a little over a century old. And you're precisely right. And that's also one of the great interesting stories, right, is how the farmers organized to basically capture some of the profits and the markets. And even today, the North Dakota Mill and Elevator, you know, mills about 10% of the wheat grown in North Dakota. I know it varies from year to year, but roughly 10%.
And the names of people that became towns or associated with the state of North Dakota were all very prominent in that milling business. Mapes, there's a town Mapes, North Dakota, but that gentleman was involved with milling, as well as Amadon, which is also a variety of wheat that was raised here by North Dakota State University for many years. But I don't remember what they did. You maybe remember their names off the top of your head and what they had done too, Bruce.
Well, Amadon was one of they were one of the original bonanza farmers, you know, with the Chafee family. And the name, you know, Chafee also is one of them. And Amarillo is and Larimore, and you're just, I'm trying to, Cooperstown, where there's a whole bunch of them named after the millers or bonanza farmers.
There's so much that happened.
The Russell Miller Milling Company started in Valley City in 1882. You know, that grew up to be the fourth largest flour milling company in America with 140 elevators and mills. They were brought out in the early 50s by the PV Company out of Minneapolis. And, you know, but so, I mean, so there's the milling in North Dakota also, I mean, that was part also of the, you know, trying to figure out how farmers could make more money and, you know, and convert some of that profit. And we're still doing today, right? I mean, to me, the announcement, you know, recently of the potato processing company from Belgium is based all on some of the same principles, right? This wonderful soil in the Red River Valley, a new variety in a different variety of potatoes, and finding incentives which way to offset the cost of transportation to major market. It's all, you know, it's the same principles, you know, 150 years later.
And Bruce, out of all, I mean, all the books and everything you've written, what is there any one particular story or event that you've written about that's your favorite, that stands out above all the rest?
Well, I do have a favorite, and that would be the cream of wheat story, which, you know, started out in 1890, 1 year after we became a state. It was a flour milling company in Grand Forks, and they hired a miller, Tom Amidon, who worked for Russell Miller Milling Company in Jamestown. And then came the 1893 panic. So we had the 1873 panic, which bankrupt, Dalrymple and gets them to North Dakota. And then the financial panic of 1893 really bankrupt this new flour mill in North Dakota. And their miller, Amidon, said, let's try hot breakfast porridge made from, you know, farina, from the white to the wheat. And Mapes, you know, then he had, like I said, a newspaper company in Mapes, North Dakota, in Nelson County. He had some printing plates from the days as the publisher with a black chef with a saucepan. And so they send out 10 cases, 36 packages to a case, so 360 packages, to their New York broker, Lamont and Corliss. And in October of 1893, they got a telegram about, never mind us sending us your flour, send us a carload of cream of wheat. And so now they are no longer in the flour business, but in the hot cereal business. You know, but in that thing, you know, they had the founders, George Bull and Emery Mapes, had raised $40,000. Bought used milling equipment in a fire sale. It turned out to be just about worthless, you know, and they had to raise some more money. They tried to sell the plant because they nearly went bankrupt in 1893. They tried to sell the plant for $5,000. There was no takers, so all the creditors, the banks in Grand Forks, had to take stock. And it turns out that this ended up created 14 millionaires, stockholders in Grand Forks from a failed flour mill. Now becomes the most successful hot breakfast cereal company in America. And it's really a very interesting story. The innovation of the product.
Right.
The innovation of, you know, and then they also, by the way, were branding and advertising geniuses. Mapes, who was a failure just about everything he did, ended up being, you know, a genius in marketing and advertising with cream of wheat. And going from text-intensive advertising in the 1800s to doing visual illustrations, replacing that text with basically happy, healthy children eating cream of wheat, marketed to women, and becomes just an unbelievable success in the art world and advertising world and nationwide. And I subsequently have collected cream of wheat art. As a matter of fact, I have 14 pieces of original art over a century old. And I do show it on rotation basis at the Sweetwaters Coffee Shop at the Olive Ann in downtown Grand Forks. So, so there's no question that cream of wheat is a favorite of mine because of, you know, it's a product innovation. It's a great entrepreneur story. They changed the art world. They changed the advertising world. He was the founder of, you know, basically of only selling and then magazines by editions sold, not editions printed. Having auditing all the magazines, because how the magazines made a lot of money is print a lot more magazines than they sold, and they, you know, check and they charge the companies for magazines printed. And he only wanted paid. He says, you know, if a magazine is printed but not sold, it's worthless to me. I only pay for those that are sold. Somebody's got to have eyeballs on it. So he changed the advertising world. And that's still how advertising is sold today, is on, you know, the number of eyeballs that are on a on an advertisement. Really very
interesting. Oh, man.
That's wild.
Bruce, we have just barely tipped any of the stories that you have. It's phenomenal. Again, I just only have two hands, so I can only hold up two of your books that you have. But
there's 150 some stories in these books, so we're not going to cover them all.
We'll have
but
to have
I
back
have
on.
A feeling, yeah, based on the messages I've been getting, we're going to have Bruce back again very soon. And folks, if you haven't had a chance, check out your local bookstores. When you said you picked up the Dalrymple book out in Bismarck, one of my favorite places to buy local history books is the Heritage Center in Bismarck. But Bruce's book is called Innovative Entrepreneurs from North Dakota, and then also of North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. Check these out. In fact, I have started posting on Sundays on our Weather and Ag in Focus Facebook page books related to agriculture, especially with authors that we've interviewed. And I will be posting about Bruce's books on there as well. So, Bruce, thank you for joining us today. I so greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks for inviting me, Bridget. I've enjoyed this.
How can people find you? Do you have a website?
I do not. The website for the books is Dakota. How did I come on, Bruce?
I'll look you up.
Oh,
you email it to me, and I'm going to connect it to everything we did.
It's DakotaBookNet.com. DakotaBookNet.com. Yeah, Smoky Water Press. You can find that's how you find them online, but you know, Ferguson Books. The State Historical Society, they also carry the book, so you can find them there.
Folks, that was a whirlwind of fun. Thank you, Bruce, and I can't wait to visit with you again soon. So be right back, folks. We still want to make sure that we go through the weather and any other questions you might have, so stay tuned.
And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. 1:56 in the afternoon, temperature 27 degrees. Temperatures a little bit warmer out to the west. Castleton's at 31. A little cooler to the east into Lakes Country, where temperatures 17 in DL. Northern Valley, temperatures in the upper 20s, same with the Southern Valley. So slightly warmer weather out to the west. I think we'll end up moving up a few more degrees here to about just 29, 30 degrees here in the FM area. And then tomorrow, that's when things start to change as a reinforcing shot of cold air comes in the morning. Winds ramp up out of the northwest at about 15 to 30 and gusty. So we'll see some blowing snow. Obviously, areas in Lakes Country where there's a little more fresh powder is going to see a little more higher risk of blowing snow, slippery roads. But even in the FM area here, I think we'll have at least minimal impacts, if not a little bit more. So if you're doing any traveling tomorrow from morning through about mid-afternoon, be aware of that with temperatures only in the teens. And then sunshine returns on Sunday with highs in the upper 20s. And next week is a full roller coaster. We start the week in the mid-30s. Middle of the week, we're in the teens. End of the week, we're in the mid-30s. So up and down next week. No big storms next week. Maybe a few snow showers midweek as the colder air arrives. But other than that, we're looking at a quiet weather week next week. Now, next weekend, not this weekend, but the following weekend, that's when we'll be starting to keep an eye on a potential storm system entering our area as we start off the month of February. Let's hope so. I mean, you know, it's wintertime. We need the moisture. And if we can get a decent snow event here, that will add to the snowpack. That always helps. And like I said, according to the LRC, the first week in February looks a little stormy. One storm, possibly two, and then possibly another one again around mid-month, a bigger storm around mid-month. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. So for Bridget and myself, I want to thank everybody for joining us here on this Friday afternoon. And don't go anywhere. The Jay Thomas Show, that's coming up next.